Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Well, this morning we are talking about all things technical and gossiping about gadgets for the next hour and a half-ish in the company of Fevzi Turkalp from the website gadgetdetective.com. So if you're having problems or seeking advice about anything with a screen or with a plug, he is definitely the man to ask. Get in touch with the programme via the usual means. Call 0500 909 693. You can text us 85058, email upallnight@bbc.co.uk, and we are at BBC 5 Live. That's the number 5 followed by live on social media. So good morning, my old friend, to Fevzi. How are you?
Morning. Good, thank you.
Good. How's the world of technology for you today?
Full and vibrant.
It really is. And what we do each week, Fevzi, you generally tend to send me a list of topics that you're interested in or that are in the news that we can have a bit of a chat about before we start to get the questions in. I can say this morning we've got a record because the top thing that you wanted to talk about today, we've already had a text about it. Steve in Hampshire has texted to say, the best new iPad option, please, when released, and is it this month?
Yeah, okay, so there are iPads coming, new ones, the iPad Pros, and the reason why we know that is because every iPad inside it has effectively got its model number built into it, and when it goes online, you can detect it, or it can be detected. And those that follow these things have been detecting iPad numbers that don't exist yet. In other words, Apple are trying them and they're being variously connected to the internet. So what do we think is going to exist? So these are the tablets. There's going to be a new 9.7-inch iPad Pro, which will probably be a fairly nominal upgrade in terms of processor and graphics and so forth. It won't be huge, we think. The new 12.9-inch iPad Pro, which is huge, you know, the standard size is 9.7, so 12.9 is really quite on the big side. By the way, good for radio studio use, I have to say those things. Those will get a bigger bump to bring them in line with them, because at the moment my iPhone 7 is actually faster than the iPad Pro, which shouldn't be because it's just a generation ahead. So you'll get a 12 megapixel camera, you'll get a faster processor, faster graphics. In addition to that, you'll get what's called a True Tone display, where the display detects the not just the brightness around it in the room, but also the tone of the light, and it will match it so that the display doesn't seem as stark and hard on the eyes. So it will do that, and probably will have an improved Apple Pencil. That's the pointing device that you can optionally buy to go with that. So we'll have improved 9.7 slightly, a significantly improved 12.9. There may or may not be a replacement for the Mini, which is a 7.9-inch one, which is the one that's about the size of a paperback book, and you can actually put your hand and hold it, you know, put your hand all the way around it, which makes a big difference. But the most interesting theory is that there will be a 10.5-inch one, and that's strange. Why would you have 10.5-inch screen when you've already got a 9.7? It's actually very close. The theory is that the one with the 10.5-inch screen will actually fit into the same size as the current 9.7, so it will cost more because they're shoehorning a bigger screen into it, and the bezel, that's to say the frame that goes around the screen, will be very, very slim. So that's probably what the future of iPads will be, and an indicator probably of what the iPhone 8 or the 8 will be like. It will have this sort of bezel-less design. So those are the differences. Maybe not huge, although if they do it for the 7.9-inch, that would be huge because that hasn't been decently upgraded in a while. But obviously, if you're about to purchase...
I was just going to say, if you're desperate for an iPad, the message from you, I'm guessing, would be don't go out and buy one tomorrow.
Hang tight. Because in terms of when... Okay, so theories on this vary, but the most common ones are sometime between next week and April. So I tend towards perhaps some sort of announcement towards the end of the month. So I think, given how long you'll be using it, unless you're absolutely, absolutely desperate, and very few people should be that desperate for anything, then hold off for a couple of weeks.
I mean, this shows that my finger is absolutely not on the technology pulse at all. But if you wanted to save yourself some cash, you waited for the new iPad to come out, could you then buy one of the old versions at a greatly reduced rate? And would it make much difference?
Yeah, no, you probably can, particularly if you're prepared not to buy it from Apple. So if you bought it from, you know, a high street store or let's say that one that's never knowingly undersold, then they will have an inventory. They'll have a certain amount of stock of the existing ones in. They would have been running their stocks down, but still they'll have some because they can't go to zero because they don't know exactly what Apple's going to announce and when they can buy them in. So those things will typically go on offer. So yes, you can do it. And especially where the improvements are marginal, you know, just incremental improvements, then, you know, if you can save £150 or something like that, it may be worth your while. Personally, I tend to think that it can be a false economy because with every generation means that it's another year off the useful life of the machine. And by that I mean Apple will sooner for your device stop supporting it with the latest operating system. And that can be a problem.
Sneaky, isn't it?
It is because, I mean, I'll give you an example. I own a first generation iPad mini. So I bought that in towards the end of 2012. That machine has got enough storage. It's got enough processor power. What it doesn't have is enough internal RAM for the programs to run. So it runs very, very slowly. And it no longer runs the latest version of iOS, the operating system. Now, compare that to an 8-year-old PC, which will still run Windows 10 quite happily. So Apple, you know, on the one hand are innovative, but the price for that, or have been innovative, the price for that is that the useful life of the machines is somewhat less.
It's a lot of money, isn't it, for something with a shorter shelf life?
Yeah, and they are, I mean, it depends how you look at it. If you divide it through, you know, per day over a sort of 3 or 4 year period, then it doesn't seem too bad. But certainly compared to other tablets, it's a lot of money. I think that they're good value, not just because of the hardware, but because of the what they call the ecosystem, so the support for apps. So, for example, one of my great personal passions is I love synthesizers, and I used to buy on eBay some of these old classic synths from the 70s and 80s and so forth. It's cost a fortune. I got rid of them all, and now I buy apps that cost pennies or a few pounds, and they are often either faithful recreations of old synths that don't go wrong and sound very, very, very nearly the same, or synths that have never existed and things that you would have paid thousands of pounds for in hardware form. You can pay a few pounds for. I'll give you an example. Moog, or what some people call Moog, is a synthesizer company that have been making classic synths. They have a synth called the Model 15. If you buy it in hardware, it's $10,000. If you buy it as an iPad app, I think it's about £30.
Goodness.
Something like that, which is a lot for an app. But actually, compared to $10,000, isn't it?
Yep, it's a steal.
And it does the same thing. It's
okay.
Equally functional. So for that reason, because of the range of quality apps, if you've a use for any of those apps, it doesn't obviously have to be synths or whatever, but you can get an app for almost anything, and the quality of them tends to be a little bit higher than the equivalents on the Android platform.
Okay, we've got Tony in Nottingham on the line. Tony's got a tablet question. Tony. Tony, yeah. You're talking to Fevzy. How can he help?
Yeah. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning, Tony.
I'd like to know, I've got two tablets, and I'd like to know, why do I have to have one provider for one and one provider for another? Why can't they both work off the same provider?
Okay, so when you talk about provider, are you talking about the provider of data via the SIM card that it's got in it?
No, the provider of the, you know, the broadband provider. And I'd like to just, can I mention them?
Yeah, please do.
Talk or Sky, because one will work off Sky and one will work off Talk. They both won't work off the same, you know, like should have a Sky, or they won't, both won't work off Talk.
Yeah.
Either one or the other.
Well, Tony, that shouldn't be the case. It would be a very unusual thing to see a tablet that was internet service provider specific. It may be that... did you buy the tablets from those particular companies? And did you buy it under some sort of contract deal?
I bought them from at a shop retailer.
Right. OK. So those things may be set up to work at the moment with one internet service provider, but that's nothing. There's nothing to say that you can't use them with others. So it should work with any internet service provider with zero or minimal configuration. So I think it's probably the way either that you're using it or the way that it's set up. Because if you think about it, if you take a tablet to, you know, a coffee shop, you would expect to be able to use their Wi-Fi.
Yes.
And that wouldn't matter what internet service provider that particular coffee shop used or public library or any public space. And it's the same with your own Wi-Fi. So I'm assuming you've got Wi-Fi in your home, is that right?
Yes. I've got TalkTalk at the time.
Right. So,
and I've tried, but one will just work off one, but the other one won't work. And then I've tried it on Skype, and I've had Sky as well, and it's been the same on that. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
How are you able to test one with each? Are you really using Wi-Fi or are you using SIM cards? Because
Wi-Fi.
So at home, do you have more than one internet service provider?
No, I've only got one now.
You've only got one and one of your tablets is not working.
I'm on TalkTalk.
Right, so for the one that's not working, Tony, what you need to do is make sure your Wi-Fi is fired up. Go into the settings of your tablet where it will actually detect all the Wi-Fi networks around it that it can detect. And one of them you should be able to identify as being your one. Yeah, it would have, you know, TalkTalk or whatever on it, maybe some identifier for your internet router. Once you've done that, you click on it, and then it will probably require you to put in a password that will sometimes be written on your Wi-Fi router itself if you haven't changed it. If you haven't changed it, by the way, do so just for security. At that point, it should then say connected, and it should then allow you to use it as standard. So that's it. I mean, all tablets have got Wi-Fi capability, and they should be agnostic in terms of it shouldn't matter. It shouldn't even know really in any meaningful sense what the internet service provider is. All it should see is a Wi-Fi signal that conforms to a certain standard, and it will be compatible with that standard, and all it will need is for the right password to be set up just for your own security.
Right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Tony. Good luck with that.
Thank you so much for your call, Tony. Really appreciate it. We've got another caller, David, in Newton Abbot in Devon. David, how can Fevzy help?
Hello there.
Hi.
This sounds like a difficult one, David. I can tell by your tone already. Go on.
I think it is. I've had a flash drive go down.
Right.
Totally. I've lost. I've got 500 of my own songs written on it, and I've lost the whole lot.
Yeah.
Now, I've been back to Lexar because it's a Lexar flash drive.
Okay.
And they said to me, well, how do you treat your flash drive? I said, well, I plug it in, do what I want to do, and then I unplug it so that if something goes AWOL on my computer, it doesn't wipe out the flash drive or do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, do you eject it?
Yeah.
I said, well, no, I just unplug it. Normally, the computer's off by the time I do that, but sometimes it isn't. I just pull it out.
Yeah.
Lexar said, well, there should be an icon come up on the bottom of your screen, which you right-click, and when the flag comes up, you click on eject.
Yes.
So that the flash drive empties itself of electricity before you unplug it, because if you unplug it, it's got electricity still in it, which can fry what's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's nothing on the packaging or on Windows to tell you to do that, because the little icon that comes up is so small.
Yeah.
If you've got a Mac computer, it does tell you.
Mm. Yeah, I understand.
But I would just like to know, is there anywhere that I can send this flash drive to try and recoup it?
Okay. Right. So second question first. Yes, there is, but these services are expensive if you need them paid for. Is the contents of the flash drive very important to you, David?
Well, yeah, it's 500 songs with all the musical arrangements and everything
right.
on it.
Okay.
I mean, I've still got them manually written, but the thought of having to type that lot out again.
Yeah. Okay. So there are companies that do this. It's not a cheap service, and even then, they don't guarantee that they can recover it because it really depends on what's happened.
When you say not a cheap service, what sort of can you give us a ballpark?
Hundreds and thousands.
Oh, really?
Not tens and hundreds.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid I wouldn't entertain that.
Yeah.
No. What annoys me is there is nothing on the packaging of flash drives to tell you.
Well. Okay, so David, there are two issues with just pulling out a flash drive, and by the way, they apply equally to external hard disk drives that also connect via USB or another connector. It is this: so if you unplug a drive without, in quotes, ejecting it, and that's not an eject button, it's a software process, but if you do that, there is a possibility that you pull it out when it's in the process of writing new information to it, and although you may not be aware that you're actively copying a file across, it could be doing something in the background that was queued up from before that you're not aware. And particularly some flash drives don't have little lights on them to show when there's activity going on. Even if you did, you know, it could just be starting to do it just as you unplug it. So there is that. So with that comes the risk of corruption of the data. That's to say that there might not be a hardware fault on the drive.
If I can interrupt there, that's never happened to me. The flash drive I'm talking about did have a little red light that used to blip when it was doing something. Now, that light was never blipping when I unplugged it. It was always after I'd completely finished everything. Mm. And in 9 times out of 10, I'd actually switch the computer off.
Yeah, no, I understand. So it can still happen even without the light on, but the light is some sort of indicator for it. So in that circumstance, what you would have there is a corruption of the data, i.e. that the physical flash drive might not be damaged, but the data on it or the formatting of the drive, that's to say, you know, the indexing system by which data can be written and recovered from it, may be damaged. And that in itself could render the drive useless. Let's hope that's what's happened, because it will give you a higher chance of recovering that data. On the other hand, there is the possibility that you can get sort of voltage spikes if you unplug from a system that's still powered. That's less likely. Or you could just be unlucky and it could just have failed just like anything else, you know,
Well, actually, a friend of mine's had exactly the same thing happen.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say Lexar as a brand are one of the better ones, but no one is immune to no brand is immune to having their tech fail. And you might just be, you know, in quotes, unlucky. It might not even be something that you've done. So if we don't want to go down the route of paying money, and it's worth, just before you decide to try and do it yourself, it is worth just going online and you know, doing a search on professional data recovery services. Yeah, that's probably the words I would use to look for. If you look for that, you may have something cheaper. You may have a no recovery, no fee service. You know, so there are some options. By the way, this is a bit afterwards, but I'll mention this for other people. There are insurance policies available that you can take out against data loss, where it will pay for these services should the need arise. And for critical devices, I'd say that's a good thing. Mm. The other thing, again, is, and I'm sorry to say this to you, David, because it's not of help to you, but if this were backed up in some way, and are you sure it hasn't been backed up somewhere over time, maybe even if it's not an up-to-date backup, is it possible you have a backup of it? That's worth just having a think about and looking through any existing backups that you have. Now, beyond that, if you can't hire a company to do it, and I do advise you to look into that first, then your only other choice is to try and use a piece of software to try and recover it. And there are pieces of software. There's one, for example, called Get Data Back. It's not a free product, but the last time I looked, it had a free version. And what the free version does is look through your device and tell you what, if anything, it can recover. And then you pay for the software only when it believes you can recover something worthwhile. So there's one called, there's a free software as well called Recover, but it's spelled R-E-C-U-V-A. And I think it's from the people that do a well-known program called CCleaner, which is a trusted program that sort of tidies up your hard drive on your computer, be it PC or Mac. So I would look at, first of all, look at the costs of it doing it professionally, because when you start running your own recovery programs on it, you increase the risk that you may further damage the data that's on there. All right. So before you do anything, check to see if there is a commercial service that looks viable for you financially. If there isn't, I'd suggest starting with Recover, R-E-C-U-V-A, and seeing where that gets you. But be aware that as soon as you go down that path, you may be damaging the data further, and because it may still be perfectly recoverable. And by the way, finally, one of the things that these companies can do is actually rebuild a faulty device. So if let's say the control circuitry in your flash drive was what had blown up, or the power or some such thing, they can actually replace those micro circuit boards, and the data may still be intact. But as you can imagine, then performing microsurgery on a flash drive is not cheap.
Well, David, thank you very much for your call. Firstly, as ever, you have an encyclopedic mind that absolutely astonishes me every time we do this programme.
This is BBC Five Live, available on the BBC iPlayer radio app. Up all night.
And you're back with myself, Faye Rusko, and Fevzi Turkamp from GadgetDetective.com, and this is the Tech Phone-In on Up All Night on BBC Five Live. Thank you for all your questions. Please keep sending them, or if it is really complicated and it's just never going to fit on a text, give us a call, 0500 909 693. If you do want to text, 85058 is the number, or you can tweet at BBC Five Live. I'm keeping an eye on all three. So, Fevzi, we've actually just someone just wants some clarification. Christina in Coatbridge has texted. We were just talking about flash drives. Christina says, sorry for my ignorance, but can you explain what a flash drive is, please?
Sure.
Is it the little USB stick, she says, or is it the big external memory?
No, and that's my fault for not explaining the term. So flash drive is sometimes also known as a thumb drive or a USB drive, and it typically relates to those ones that are about the size of your thumb, and slot into one of those rectangular USB slots on the side or back of your computer.
Brilliant. I'm guessing that Christina's going to be a little more careful with her USB stick if she has one.
But I would just say that most of the comments I made about, you know, ejecting and the need for backups and insurance, they apply equally to external hard drives, which may use rotating hard disks or may use a technology called solid state device or SSD.
It's a minefield, Fevzi. It's an absolute minefield. Let's move on to another minefield. This is a text from Adam, who says, a slight tangent. My iPhone 6 is out of contract with the car phone warehouse next month after a 24-month contract on O2. Who do I talk to about upgrading? Should I wait until the iPhone 8? Now, there's loads of things about this that I find quite interesting. And I'll run through them first of all. So the first one is Carphone Warehouse. What are the pluses and minuses with going with somebody like that? The second one is, should you ever get a contract as long as 24 months? And the third one is, a friend of mine has says it's much cheaper. I don't know if this is correct. You can tell me. You can buy now an iPhone direct from Apple, and then just get a SIM-only deal with your provider.
Right. Okay. So some excellent questions. Right. So with regard to Adam's question about, you know, can he upgrade and who does he talk to about it? My first question to Adam would be, do you need to upgrade? If your iPhone 6 works, is there something that the iPhone 7, for example, does that is worthwhile to you? Because as soon as you upgrade, you're obviously not only laying out an amount of cash either up front or by virtue of another contract, but you know, you're going to start to get that device dropping in value very quickly. Most devices, you know, drop much of their value, about half their value, in the first year. So, you know, it's actually just going to cost you money to swap. So is that really worthwhile? And particularly, so after the 6 generation, there was a 6S and now the 7. So the 6 is about 2 years old. Most users of the 6 don't need a 7. some may want one, but that's not the same thing. It's fine if you decide you want one, but just be aware that you've also got the option of keeping going for another year or two at least. I mean, the 6 will still run the latest operating system, although on paper it's not as fast as the 7. Most people would never notice the difference.
Can I ask what's the difference between, why don't they just call them 6, 7, 8, 9? Why is there a 6S?
Okay, so the S's are the typically the in-between years, and they represent an incremental improvement, whereas okay. the 6 to the 7 should be more of a step change.
Okay.
That's not always the case, but that's it. And there is, by the way, a rumor that the iPhone 8 will be called the iPhone X.
Just to confuse me.
Yeah, because it's the 10th anniversary of the launch of the original iPhone by Steve Jobs. So they may have an X edition of it, which is, again, just marketing. But bear in mind, you know, they're not the only ones to jump all over the place. Windows, went from 7, 8. There was no Windows 9. There was Windows 10. Because Windows 8 had such a bad reputation, they wanted to put some
distance between them.
Clear blue water, yeah, absolutely. So that's the first thing. Do you need to do it? If you do, it is true that in most cases it's cheaper to buy a phone outright, be it directly from Apple or another retailer, what's called a SIM-free phone, and then get, as you say, a SIM-only deal. The reason why it's usually cheaper is because not only when you get a contract, be it 24 months or whatever, there are three elements to that. One is you're paying for the service, the airtime, the amount of data and minutes and texts. That's one component. Then you're paying back for the device over time, be it 12, 18 or 24 months. So they'll slice it up. But then the third element is you're actually effectively paying interest. Now, they'll never separate that out and say that you are, but you're not getting an interest-free loan.
Of course not.
You're paying interest, and therefore, if you've got the money and can afford to buy it up front, it's better and it's simpler, because the contracts are simpler and you have far more can have far more flexibility as well in what you do going forward.
The other option, when you just talk about buying them outright, sorry to interrupt, is if you don't have the money, you could always put them on a 0% interest credit card.
Yeah, and I
and pay it off over a a 2-year contract.
I think
is that an option?
It is an option. I'd always be careful about advising people to borrow, and particularly to borrow on credit cards. You need to be very careful, particularly with credit card borrowing, because the way credit cards make their money is when people forget or don't keep up with payments, and then the interest rates can be punitive. Be careful with that. But yes, if you're savvy and you're organized and you diarize things properly, if you're that sort of person, then it can work for you. You also asked me about Carphone Warehouse and what are the benefits of going there. The benefits of going to somewhere, not just Carphone Warehouse, but these non-network specific vendors, so ones that don't just sell you O2 or EE, one of their own shops, is that you get a choice of contracts from a single provider. Mm-hmm. And that choice is generally a good thing, but again, it's tricky with contracts because you have to pay great attention to them. And the reason, by the way, why we have 24 month contracts is because the phones are so expensive at the particularly at the top end, that 12 months or 18 months isn't always enough to repay the phone and the interest, in affordable chunks. So that's the reason why it happens. The last bit of advice I'd give Adam is, if you do go for a contract, be it SIM only or one that involves, a free handset or a subsidized handset, get the contract at a distance. And by that, I mean either online or at least over the phone, because your rights of cancellation of the contract are stronger in law when you've purchased the contract at a distance
really?
Than if you've purchased it in a shop.
I would have thought it'd be the opposite way around.
No, the thing about distance purchases is that the law sort of tries to allow you to have the same chance to try something out as you would have had in a store. Now, obviously, that doesn't really apply to mobile phone contracts. It would have applied to, a TV set or something. You don't get to see the TV set working in the shop when you buy it online. Therefore, your right to return it is enhanced in law. Having said that, you know, a lot of stores and vendors and networks have, you know, cancellation policies which are almost as good or sometimes even better than the law, but you don't have the legal right to fall back on in quite the same way. And and as I've said, because there's no real benefit to buying it in a store, the contract, you know, you can't try out a contract in the store and decide whether it works for you, then you might as well buy it online. You know, there are benefits to doing that. So the only other advice I would give you is this. Try to check what the likely strength of signal is going to be for you in your area or the areas where you're most likely to be using the phone. So the networks themselves produce their own maps of coverage, and Ofcom produce a map of coverage. Now, these at best are indicative, but it can also add to your argument if you need to cancel the contract that you actually... I'll give you an example. I'll name the network because it actually applies to all networks at one time or another. I got a contract with EE. I checked on the EE coverage map. It said that I could expect about 4 bars of signal for both data and calls. I checked with Ofcom. It said something similar. The reality was at my address, I got between 0 and 1 bar.
Oh, dear.
I had to cancel the contract. I'd done all my homework, but there was just nothing. So Ofcom have recognised this, and what they're actually doing is they've produced an app that runs on Android smartphones that people can download, and that will give them data about the true nature of coverage on certain networks. You know, so it knows where you are because, you know, there's a GPS location on the phone, and it can measure the signal and report that back to Ofcom. If you're happy with that, that's kind of a public-spirited thing to do, I'd say. But just be aware those network coverage maps aren't completely accurate, to say the least.
So here's a scenario for you then, which I'm sure is pretty common. I had a phone on with a certain provider. Halfway through the contract, I moved house. In my new house, 0, 1 yeah. bar if I was lucky, and just had to wait. Well, I thought I just had to wait. I just had to wait until I could change the contract. I didn't know that I was moving house. I didn't plan on moving house. There would have been no way of me getting out of that contract, would there?
Well, yeah. I mean, legally, you would have been beyond the reasonable time in which you could have handed back the contract. But, you know, networks are not always completely heartless. And sometimes, you know, they will make gestures to customers that they don't legally have to do, you know, just in the spirit of customer service. I find it often helps when you ring a radio station and say, I'm having this problem, and then ring them and tell them you're going to ring the radio station back. It's amazing how a bit of publicity helps that sort of thing. But sometimes they do look upon it kindly. But if you can think of it from their point of view, you know, they can't and don't guarantee good coverage in every location. I guess your argument would be, if you looked up their network coverage map at your new home's location and it says you should have a good signal and you don't, then you could argue that, well, you know, that's misleading, and you could possibly even argue that you looked up that area previously when you took out the contract. But, you know, your legal rights under those circumstances are limited because, you know, no contract and no network works well everywhere. You know, there are dead spots everywhere. Even if the geographic area on a map generally shows as being good because there's no, you know, the rise of the land doesn't block the signal and it's quite high and it's near a mast, you may have specific problems. You may have the structure of a building, if it has a lot of metal in it, it can act as what's called a Faraday cage and block signals to an extent, or you can actually even have interference from other sources as well. So there can be many reasons that are very specific to your location, you know, your house even, that you know, no network map will ever take into account.
You spoke earlier about wanting or needing to upgrade, whether you want or need the latest phone. I'm with you there, actually. But what if you need a new phone, you've damaged it, you've cracked the screen, you're coming up to an upgrade and you think, actually, I don't want to spend all that money. I'm not bothered about the latest phone. What do you think about some of these refurb phones that you can get? Do you have any warnings about those?
Yeah, it's down to who does the refurbishing. If it's a manufacturer refurb, that tends to be pretty good.
How do you find that out from these websites?
It should be advertised as such. They should say who's done the refurb, and if it doesn't say, it's probably just the vendor.
Understand.
There are some vendors that do good refurbs, but as a rule, the manufacturer's refurbs tend to be of a higher standard. I'll give you an example with Apple Kit. The only real difference that you can tell between one of their new items and a refurb, be it a computer or a tablet or a phone, is the packaging is different. Otherwise, it wouldn't have marks on it. When they refurb, they often just replace the case and the glass.
Who
was
that? Sorry.
Who
did you say did that?
Apple.
Oh, right.
So
Apple sell their own refurb phones?
Yeah. If you go on their website, there's a refurb section on it where you can look at all the different product categories. So you can get... by the way, you asked me about what happens when there's a new product out. And I said, well, if you get it from a third-party vendor, you can get the old one. The other way you can get the old ones from the manufacturer itself is look on their refurb section. Yeah, because often what happens is... store display models or even brand new models get sold as refurbs just after an upgrade because they were sitting in inventory and Apple won't sell them on their website as new anymore because it's not a current model anymore.
Yeah.
So it goes into refurb. But quite frankly, I'm very pernickety about quality of products, and I buy certain things refurb, and certainly from Apple, I'll happily do it because you get the same warranty. It's a bit cheaper. And the only difference is the packaging. Frankly,
I've never
had a product, a manufactured refurb product, and particularly from Apple, but this would apply to a greater extent to other manufacturers. I've never had one fail early, or I never. Came away having owned it for a period thinking, oh, it did less well because it was a refurb.
That's really interesting. Okay, let's take a couple of calls now. We've got Charles in Cambridge. Charles, how can we help?
Good morning.
Morning to you. How are you?
Fine.
Good.
I've got a desktop.
Yeah.
Because it's a desktop, it's obviously stuck in my office upstairs.
Yes.
I've got smartphones, smart televisions throughout the house. But what I don't have is if I'm downstairs in the lounge somewhere, something that I can go onto the internet quickly. So I'm thinking of buying a laptop or a tablet,
yep.
Or possibly the hybrid Surface Pro 4 or a Surface Book. Or if you can suggest an alternative, which would be the best.
Okay, Charles.
I wanted to run Windows 10 Office, and because of the smart televisions, etc., I won't be watching anything on the actual laptop itself. So it's just for ordinary browsing, checking things, emails, etc.
Right. Okay. Charles, excellent question, if I may say, and flatter you in saying that. So if you need to run Windows, whilst you can get tablets that work as sort of two-in-one type devices where they work as a laptop 1 minute and a tablet the next. My experience is that Windows 10 is not yet at a point where it works well on just a tablet with no keyboard. All right. So although you could do it at a push, I wouldn't try and do anything useful on it. If your main use was what they call consumption, that's to say viewing things rather than typing things and creating your own data, then a tablet is fine. And if it runs Windows 10, that's also fine. But if you want it for, word processing, if you want it for video editing, although all of these things can be done on the tablet form factor, you tend to end up sort of pairing it with a keyboard of some sort. So if it's just, as I say, watching movies and stuff, fine, go ahead, get a tablet, and you can get some cheapish Windows 10 tablets. If, however, you want to be typing, and you want the screen propped up always for you in the way that a laptop does, or if you want to use it sitting it on your lap as opposed to holding it in your hand and typing with your thumbs, then I'd say a laptop of some sort. You mentioned the Surface Pros. They're excellent. They're not cheap, but if they're within your budget, I would say, they give you a very usable computer in a form factor which is... light, well made. I would say to the same sort of quality as Apple Kit in terms of the hardware. So if you know, if that's within your budget, that's obviously one way you could go.
The Surface Pro or the Surface Book are both within my budget.
Yeah. Well, the Surface Book is excellent. The Surface Book's that one with the slightly funky hinge design on
it. That's right,
I don't know if you've seen it, where when you fold the screw, I'll just try and describe it, although not easy on radio, but when you fold it over, normal laptops, the screen then sits snug, completely snug against the keyboard when you close it. With the Surface Book, it's kind of like, it looks like a spine. If you imagine a spine that you were able to bend, an animal spine, you could bend it over, it doesn't sit quite flush, so there's actually a space where you can get your sort of little pinky finger into the gap. Some people hate that, some people like it because it kind of looks like something organic. And as I'm sure you know, with the Surface Book, you can undock, you press a button on the keyboard, you hear a little whir and click, and then you can actually undock the screen and use it as a tablet. Be aware that with the Surface Book, some of the battery is in the keyboard section. So when you undock it, although it does have battery, it will have less battery than when it's docked to the keyboard section. So that's something to bear in mind, but that's excellent. Also, just checking when the Surface Pro 4 was launched, my guess is that there'll be a replacement for it soon. So it depends how
that is anticipated in April, May.
Yeah.
And so, the same with Surface Book 2.
Yeah. So again, particularly because that sort of two-in-one form factor is still evolving, you probably, with the 5, you're going to get more, the new generation, you're probably going to get more than just a speed bump. They'll probably iron out some of the sort of the physical flaws of the design as well. So I think if you're not desperate, it's probably worth waiting. And again, if you're then happy with the Surface Pro 4, you'll be able to buy it a little bit cheaper than once the 5 is out.
Okay, let's try and get one more question in before the news. Michael in Highbury in London. Michael, how can we help?
Yeah, hi. I spoke, is it Phil? Yeah, I spoke to him last year how...
It's Febsy, but close.
Yeah, sorry.
That's just all right.
No problem.
Before Christmas, Microsoft done a major upgrade to Windows 10 and totally ruined my computer.
Yep.
I've now gone down... I lost Word, Excel, which I need for work, and I've now gone down the freeware route.
Yep.
I'm going to look into it more than anything else, possibly going completely freeware and having, which is apparently an excellent system, which is Ubuntu.
Yeah.
My brother, who's a computer and electronics expert, has said that you can't use two operating systems on the same computer. And he said, I don't know the technical thing involved.
Yeah.
He said I could download and run Ubuntu from a DVD.
Right.
What he did say to me, though, is in regards to a friend who's had problems, that Ubuntu is particularly different to... Microsoft. And the other thing I'd have to investigate, because following on from a previous call to you again, was that I've got Norton Internet Security and whether Ubuntu can be supported or can support Norton.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Michael. So there's a lot of questions there.
And we've got about 2.5 minutes, so it's going to have to be a roundup, Febsy. I'm really sorry.
All right, no problem. So free software is a good way to go, and things like Liberty Office that are compatible with Microsoft Office are excellent. It's not correct to say that you can't run two operating systems on a computer. You can do what's called dual booting, where you install the two operating systems on there. You have to know what you're doing or get someone who knows what they're doing, but then you can do it in such a way that as you switch on the machine, you choose which one it uses. So you know, you would have to restart the computer to change the operating system. Ubuntu is a distribution, a version of the Linux operating system, and as such is very different from Windows, so you'd have a learning curve. It's not as user friendly as Windows, but once you're used to it, there are people who love it and swear by it, and it's a good operating system and it's free, but the software that's available on it is then not compatible with Windows, so you'd have to source new software that would include your Norton Internet Security in addition to that, for Mac users, you can run, even for PC users, you can run a virtualization software where you can test out a new operating system in a virtual box on your PC and see if you like it before you go dual booting or replacing the existing operating system.
Okay.
So I think I'm under 2.5 minutes.
You are well under 2.5 minutes. I'm going to have to find some more questions now. Thanks, Fuzzy. And thank you for the call, Michael. Jim in Folkestone says, you talk about new versions of tablets, etc. As a retired trading standards officer, I'm appalled at the lack of standardisation in the industry and can only conclude that people have more money than sense. Has only a few ever used Full Potential? Why this mania to upgrade? Hear, hear, Jim. What do you think?
Yeah, so the need of the industry to sell us new gadgets outweighs our need to have new gadgets, and that's why there's advertising and marketing and all the rest of it. One of the reasons why you get more churn or more sort of replacement of some devices like smartphones and tablets is that those devices as a category are less established, and therefore they are still seeing meaningful improvements over the years, whereas Windows PCs are evolving, but they've been around for a lot longer. So that's why a sort of 7-year-old PC can still be doing a very functional job, whereas a tablet, which is still sort of growing in its capabilities, may not.
But we're still obsessed, aren't we, with getting the newest first?
Yeah, and we don't have to. It's actually better to get the best out of the gadget you've got. And particularly with things like cameras, don't be upgrading your camera every year. Just learn how to use it and make better photos.